Over the years, over the decades, we've devoted countless programs to the Arab-Israeli conflict. And while it's often been mentioned in dispatches, we've never focused on the Balfour Declaration. Well, now's the time to do it, because it's the centenary. It's the perfect time to ponder what was a 67-word letter written by British Foreign Minister Arthur Balfour on, yes, the 2nd of November 1917. It began thus, "Dear Lord Rothschild," and promised that the British government would look with favour on the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine. Now, on the 100th anniversary, Ian Black, former Middle East editor for The Guardian, has written a superb history, "Enemies and Neighbours, Arabs and Jews in Palestine and Israel, 1917 to 2017. Now, Ian is now a senior fellow at the Middle East Study Centre at the LSE, and he joins us from our studio in London. Ian, welcome back.
Hi, thanks. Nice to be with you again.
Would you tell me why the letter was addressed to Rothschild?
Lord Rothschild then was the most prominent figure in the British Jewish community towards the end of the First World War. I don't think he had an official position, but obviously it was a well-known name. And he was the recipient of the letter, as you've described it, from the British government. And it was described as a declaration in favour of what were described as Jewish Zionist aspirations. And the point of that was, at the time, the Zionist movement, people who wanted to see a Jewish homeland in Palestine, had been lobbying hard. And the moment came 100 years ago that the British government responded. And the key thing that the letter said, you're right, just the 67 words, but the most important line was that His Majesty's government views with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. That was an extraordinary achievement for what was then a small and struggling movement, a minority in the world Jewish community.
Ian, if the letter was controversial then, it certainly maintained its notoriety. I understand there's something of significance happening in London Thursday evening involving Theresa May and Benjamin Netanyahu, among others.
It's extraordinary how much is going on around this centenary. But you're right, the most closely watched event is taking place in the evening on November the 2nd. And that's a dinner. It's organised by the present Lord Rothschild, the descendant of the Lord Rothschild of a century ago, and indeed the present Lord Balfour, who is, I think, is the great-great-nephew of the Lord Balfour, who was then the British Foreign Secretary. Theresa May is attending that dinner, and so is Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister. It's attracting a lot of attention, both positively and negatively.
I understand that there's a no-show and that Jeremy Corbyn has declined to attend.
Jeremy Corbyn, of course, the leader of the opposition Labour Party, who's quite well known for his reasonably outspoken positions on the Israel-Palestine issue. He's very pro-Palestinian, and he's declined the invitation to attend that dinner, which has been the subject of some controversy. It's been greeted by pro-Palestinian voices and condemned by pro-Israeli ones. The whole point about this centenary is that it is remarkable how polarized things are, both in understanding the history of a century ago and the current situation today, which in many ways can be traced back to what happened in November 1917.
Well, look at that, the resonances, the echoes a little later. I'm talking to Ian Black, who was the former Middle East editor with The Guardian, and he's now visiting senior fellow with the Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics. You use the term contested anniversary for both supporters and detractors. Talk to that.
Well, I think what you have to understand is you look back at this event. It's happening towards the end of the First World War. The British are, frankly, struggling. The first part of the Russian Revolution has taken place earlier that year in February or March, depending on the calendar. The United States has entered the war after long hesitations, but the British are in trouble. They're bogged down on the Western Front, their Commonwealth allies, not the Commonwealth, but their allies, including, of course, Australia, are busy fighting as well, including in Palestine. And they're worried that they're going to be left alone fighting the Turks. The Turks, the Ottoman Empire, has, at the end of 1914, had joined the war, declaring a jihad against the British, the French, and the Russians. The Turks have managed to mount an attack, albeit a failure, on the Suez Canal, strategic waterway for the British on the route to India. And they are casting around for things to help them win the war and secure the peace as they want to see it. And that's the context. When the declaration is issued, it is an absolute triumph for the Zionist movement. This is the greatest power on earth, has given its endorsement to the idea of national rights for the Jewish people in the Holy Land, as they see it, their ancient homeland.
Was Balfour the driving force, or was he answering instructions from Number 10 or from the Foreign Office?
The key figures in this story on the British side are Balfour and Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, Liberal Prime Minister. He's a Welshman who's grown up with a classically, Protestant nonconformist education. He knows the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament, inside out. The history of the Jews is very familiar to him. Balfour similarly has that sort of outlook on Jewish history. This idea that the Jews will be restored to their biblical homeland is a strand, of course, in Christian thinking. So there's a sentimental religious aspect to it, certainly. But the motives of the British government collectively are strategic. They're not sentimental. They're not romantic. They're about doing something that will help them win the war. They believe that by being favorable to Zionist aspirations, they will help secure the support of Jews in Russia and in America to continue fighting the war. But they're also thinking about what happens afterwards. They're very concerned about long-standing British rivalry with the French. There have been conflicting guarantees or promises or pledges given to the Arabs as well. That's a very important part of the story. The Arabs, led by the Hashemite dynasty in what is today's Saudi Arabia, are trying to secure Arab independence from the Turks. They launched the famous revolt against the Turks with the help of Lawrence of Arabia. And they think that they've been promised Palestine as part of their future Arab kingdom.
Well, there is a sort of codicil, isn't there, in the Balfour statement, which guarantees the protection of Palestinians.
But there are two really important qualifications. Again, just the 67 words and the three elements we've talked about, the promise to promote the establishment of a Jewish state in Palestine. But the qualifications matter. And the first of those says that nothing must be done to prejudice what it calls the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities. That's an important phrase that we might need to come back to. There's another qualification about the rights of Jews living in other countries. Now, the historic importance of the Balfour Declaration largely rests on that guarantee not to prejudice the civil and religious rights of the non-Jews. They constituted at the time around 90% of the population of the country. They weren't consulted, and that rankles to this day with Arabs, Palestinians, and people who support them, that their homeland, as they saw it, was given to another people. Now, we can talk a lot about the Jewish connection to the Holy Land and so on and so forth, but the Arab perception was and remains that the Balfour Declaration gave to one people, a country that was not theirs. That's the nub of it.
Talking to Ian Black about the Balfour Declaration, and at that event tomorrow night, which will be attended by the Currents, Lord Rothschild and Balfour, is echoed by any number of events being organised by Jewish communities across the UK. And I notice with interest that Christian Zionists who believe in the unerring power of biblical prophecy are to celebrate at the Albert Hall under the slogan, Partners in This Great enterprise. Now, Ian, what do you think of Netanyahu's comments at the remembrance celebrations at the Battle of Beersheba only yesterday, when he said that the Australian victory paved the way for the Balfour Declaration? Is that kosher?
Yeah, it's pretty kosher. The Australian forces were part of the Egyptian Expeditionary Force, as it was called, under the command of General Allenby. The Australians, starting in the spring of 1917, first they were involved in two battles for Gaza, the same Gaza that we know of today in the Gaza Strip. And then late October, early November, they win the Battle of Beersheba. That's a city now in southern Israel, which was then a small town in what was southern Palestine, Ottoman Palestine. And the British and their allies were advancing on the Turks. And it was in that context, of course, that the Balfour Declaration was issued. Lloyd George famously said at some point around this time that what he really wanted was for Jerusalem to be captured, because that would make a wonderful Christmas present. And indeed, Jerusalem was captured in early December, about a month, 5 to 6 weeks after the Balfour Declaration had been issued. But the Australian forces played a very significant role in that fight against the Ottoman Turks, who were eventually defeated and driven from the land of Palestine, or the area of Palestine that they had ruled for 400 years.
I can imagine reviewers, Israeli and Palestinian, taking you to task for being so even-handed. You give equal weight to both narratives.
Well, there's lots of books have been written on this subject, as you know. So what was I trying to achieve in writing yet another one? One of the things I wanted to do, and of course people will have to judge whether I've succeeded, was to tell the story of this enduring conflict, to tell it of and from both sides. And you're right, I expect there will be people who will be unhappy with that, because the way that the protagonists view their own history, and of course that's a generalization, but you know, you have to use generalizations. The way Israelis and Palestinians see their own history is completely different. Their interpretations, their narratives are irreconcilable. If you stand back, you want to understand it, you have to explain that, and you have to tell things as they really happened, and often to give a sense of the contested version of many, many events. What's striking is that in factual terms these days, as I found as I worked on this book, in factual terms, there aren't that many differences anymore. For example, it is quite clear how many Palestinians were driven or expelled from their homes in the war of 1948, when Israel came into existence. Nobody disputes the numbers. Intentions are a different matter. Was there a master plan, or did it just happen? Those kind of disagreements still exist. But on the facts, there isn't that much to argue about anymore. You constantly have to bear in mind that the two protagonists have very different views of the same events and their interpretation of those events and who was responsible for them.
Let's go back to that marvellous quote of Hungarian-born Jewish writer Arthur Koestler: one nation solemnly promised to a second nation the country of a third. I guess there were immediate protests from Arabs in Palestine.
The protest began not immediately, but as the news filtered through of the Balfour Declaration, it caused great unease. I think it's important to remember, to remind people also that, you know, what happened in November 1917 was an enormously important advance for the Zionist movement. But it didn't begin with that. Zionist settlement in Palestine, in Turkish Ottoman Palestine, had begun 30 years or so before, in the early 1880s. So while there were Jews who had lived in the Holy Land, in Palestine, in Eretz Israel, as Jews called it, for many, many decades, for traditional religious reasons, from the 1880s, there were people who came with this new idea of building a Jewish homeland that they would rule or control. So it wasn't brand new. When the Balfour Declaration was issued, and Britain conquered Palestine, that was the beginning of a new chapter. And the country's native Arabs, Muslims and Christians, realized quite quickly that this was very bad news for them. The place they saw as their homeland, however defined, and there's lots of arguments about that sort of definition, but the British had promised to create a national home for the Jewish people. The Jewish people at that time were a small minority of the population, and the newcomers, these Zionist settlers, were behaving rather differently from the Orthodox immigrants or natives. There were plenty of native-born Palestinian Jews who spoke Arabic or Yiddish or other languages. But the Balfour Declaration marked the beginning of a new stage, and the Arabs realized that immediately.
How did Jews and Palestinians get on prior to Balfour?
They get on okay, actually. There's an image out there of, but with elements of truth, of course, of the intolerance of Muslims to non-Muslims, that's Christians and Jews, of course, as well. But actually, in the Ottoman period, they lived reasonably well together. The Jews and the Christians had an inferior status under Islamic law, that's correct. But beyond that, they weren't really oppressed. There was a good deal of coexistence, of people respecting each other's traditions and holidays, especially in cities like Jerusalem and in Hebron and elsewhere in Palestine. It wasn't perfect. It was an Islamic system. But Christians and Jews were tolerated. There's an Arabic phrase about the people of the book. And that was basically the picture. But things did begin to change when the Zionist movement began to show that it was out for something rather different.
Post-Balfour, there's an increase in the number of Jewish immigrants, and this does trigger a lot of violence.
The key thing that happens in the years after Balfour is just a declaration made by the British government. By the way, it's important to note, it's a public declaration, which is different from the secret or the confidential pledges or agreements that have been made before. The thing that really changes is when the British are in control of the whole of Palestine. By the end of 1918, the Turks have been completely defeated. Palestine is under British and Allied control. And then in 1922, the British government is given a mandate to rule Palestine by the League of Nations. That's, of course, the forerunner of the United Nations. And the terms of the Balfour Declaration, the promotion of a Jewish national home, are written in to the League of Nations mandate. And that means it now has the force of international law. The key things that happen under the League of Nations mandate, as far as the Zionists are concerned, is that immigration of Jews is allowed, land sales are possible, and there is the beginning of an autonomous Jewish society with its own institutions. The use of the Hebrew language becomes very important as well, which is being revived from having been for many centuries a language of liturgy. It becomes a language of everyday life. And you have the creation in this still Arab-majority country of an independent, autonomous, if you like, Jewish society, which is protected by the British administration and the legal position accorded by the mandate. And from that period onwards, from then onwards, relations between Arabs and Jews do get worse. And they culminate, of course, in what happened in 1948.
You make an interesting point. It has never occurred to me that various anniversaries of the Balfour Declaration become significant dates in the Arab-Israeli conflict, 37, 47, the Six-Day War in 67.
It's extraordinary. Almost every decade since 1897, the seventh year of that decade, marks a significant development in the story of this continuing conflict. I mean, I joke sometimes that I'm really braced for 2027. God knows what is going to happen if this pattern continues. But the most striking dates are indeed Balfour in 1917, and then 50 years later, a half century, very neatly, you have the extraordinarily important watershed of the 6 Days War of that year, when Israel conquered the rest of mandatory Palestine and controlled exactly the same area that the British had done 50 years earlier. It's an amazing coincidence. It almost makes you believe in something occult, but I think it's just coincidence.
I don't think you're a numerologist, Ian, but it is a compelling and fascinating fact. Now, whilst Theresa May, Netanyahu and not Jeremy are meeting tomorrow, I guess there won't be wild parties on the Palestinian side.
The Palestinians are very angry at the way this anniversary is being marked. And I use the word marked advisedly because actually that's what the British government says about it. There's been an interesting shift, quite a subtle one, but nevertheless noticeable. The British government knew perfectly well in advance that this was going to be a difficult thing to handle. I remember over a year ago going to a sort of private seminar at the Foreign Office where these people were sitting around, you know, looking quite worried and scratching their heads. How are they going to deal with all these anniversaries? Of course, last year we had the anniversary of the famous Sykes-Picot Agreement. That was the agreement between Britain and France and Russia to carve up the post-Ottoman Middle East. They worried about that, and they worried about Balfour. And they'd come up with a line last year which was quite carefully thought out. Now, they said something like, the Balfour Centenary, we will mark it, but we will not celebrate it, and nor will we apologise for it. So you had an interesting, everything was reflected in that sentence. Mark, not celebrate, but not apologise.
It's interesting that this week we're also, of course, celebrating Martin Luther banging away on the church door, and we've got the small matter of the Bolshevik Revolution. We are
absolutely
buried between beneath these, aren't we?
What I think is interesting about the Balfour one is that, you know, I mean, centenaries come and go, anniversaries come and go, and sometimes they attract attention and sometimes they don't. What I'm struck by with this one is really how much attention it's attracting for and against. And that's because it reflects the unmistakable fact that the conflict, whose origins can really be traced to that event, is still going on. It's
let's spend the few minutes we've got left looking at that. The Palestinians would agree that the legacy of Balfour is toxic for them, but the Israeli journalist Anshel Pfeffer says that it's toxic for Israelis as well, that both sides are clinging to historical myths.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree. Anshel is a friend and a colleague of mine, and we've had this discussion, not really resolved it. I mean, I think that its importance is, I think it's, you know, what it says on the tin. It really does matter. It really was a very significant moment. It's so significant, by the way, that when Israel became independent in May 1948 and it issued a declaration of independence, the Balfour Declaration was referenced in that as the most important milestone in terms of international recognition of the idea of a Jewish homeland. And I would be astonished if when Netanyahu is in London in the next few days, he doesn't make that point as well. The Balfour Declaration is important in terms of Israel's sense of its own legitimacy. And on the other side of the coin, it's very important to the Palestinians because it represents what was for them the beginning of their dispossession, the loss of their homeland, their refugee status, and in, depending on how you define it, an occupation that persists to this day. So I don't think it's a myth. I think it is really important.
Okay, it's just time for me to ask you one more question, but the answer will have to be brief. Any hope for optimism?
I don't see it. I think that things are as bad now as they've been for a long, long time. The last effort that could be described as a serious peace initiative took place under the Clinton administration, and John Kerry, the then US Secretary of State, gave up. That was in 2014. So it's over 3 years since there's been anything Netanyahu's government is the most right-wing government in Israel's history. It's fully behind the project of settlement in the occupied territories. The Palestinians are divided, though there are some signs of a rapprochement to end the division between Mahmoud Abbas, the president, and Hamas, the Islamist movement in Gaza. But to imagine that a peace initiative anytime soon is going to work, Donald Trump talks about the deal of the century. There are all kinds of things going on involving Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. But the core of the conflict between Israel and Palestinian seems to me, a century on from Balfour, to be harder than ever to resolve, and people are issuing dire warnings.
And of course, the Pentecostalists who are amongst Trump's base are almost ecstatic with delight because it could lead to the end times.
I mean, there you go back to what we talked about earlier, you know, that sort of strain of Christian fundamentalism that talks about the restoration of the Jews to the Holy Land. I mean, that's all fine, but you've got to stay in the present day and in real life and understand that you can't turn back the clock, and that there are two people who, it seems to me now, are doomed, whether they like it or not, and people on both sides don't particularly like it, to live in the same small country. And I think that what's happening with this centenary, it is a reminder of how difficult it is to achieve that and how intractable the conflict between Arabs and Jews in the Holy Land still is.
Isn't it interesting that this has to be the world's most contested piece of real estate?
I think that's absolutely right. Contested, disputed, it is hard to think of something worse than that. But nevertheless, that underlines the importance of trying to do something about it.
Ian, how the hell did you get the book out in time?
Well, I did think ahead that it might be good to try and do something in the course of this anniversary-laden year. So I'm an old journalist, I'm an old hack, I met my deadlines, and I think I somehow managed to, you know, morally pressure my excellent publishers into doing the same.
Well, congratulations, Ian. It's a fine piece of work. And let me remind you, dear listener, that Ian is a regular on our little program, Ian Black, The Guardian's former Middle East editor, European editor, diplomatic editor, and foreign leader writer. And the new book, perfectly timed, Enemies and Neighbours, Arabs and Jews in Palestine and Israel, 1917 to 2017, is published by Allen Lane tomorrow on the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration.